Hi, it's Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for listening to On Point. If you love this show, you may also love other great podcasts, shows, and journalism brought to you by NPR. When you support your local public radio station, it helps us keep our show going and helps NPR create new ones. The best way to keep On Point and NPR strong is to donate to your station. Visit donate.npr.org/onpoint to give. Then share why you did using the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. And thanks. From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a big, beautiful Christmas present in the form of a tax cut. That's what President Trump has promised the American people, a finished tax overhaul wrapped in a bow by Christmas. The Senate takes up its version of the plan this week, with Republicans yearning for a legislative win. But big concerns are on the table that the plan hurts the poor, could be a wash for the middle class, gives major cuts and benefits to wealthy Americans, and drives up the deficit. This hour on Point, the Senate takes on American taxes. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see coming? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Lindsey Graham put it, I think, as a lot of Republicans would this week on CNN's State of the Union yesterday. Republican Senator, South Carolina, says this must pass.
Failure is not an option when it comes to the Republican Party and cutting taxes. To every Republican senator, the fate of the party is in our hands, as well as that of the economy. The economy needs a tax cut, and the Republican Party needs to deliver, so I think we'll get there.
Let's dive in. To look at all this, we've invited David Leonhardt, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and associate editorial page editor at The New York Times, founding editor of The Upshot, former Washington bureau chief for The Times. He writes a daily email newsletter, Opinion Today, and he has been all over the tax plan and debate around it. David Leonhardt, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
You're a columnist. You can say what you like. You said it's a dreadful piece of policy. Why?
Well, so I'll actually start with just a little bit of good news about it, because I think it helps people understand how it went so badly astray. So this aspires to be tax reform. It isn't simply cutting tax rates. And the classic tax reform cuts rates and gets rid of tax breaks. It simplifies the tax code.
Cut away the undergrowth that grows up over time as people look for special favors.
That's right. And so if you do that, you should make the tax code and by extension the economy more efficient, because people don't have to spend a lot of time basically gaming their business or their own personal income to reduce their taxes. And so this is a mix of reduced tax rates and clearing out some of that underbrush. It commits its cardinal sin because it places so much emphasis on having an enormous tax cut for the affluent and really focuses on the very wealthy. And so because it does that so much, basically a lot of the getting rid of tax breaks ends up harming the poor and the middle class. And it doesn't even go so far as to pay for the tax breaks for the wealthy. So what you have is a bill that starts out trying to be tax reform, but because it puts so much emphasis on cutting taxes that fall on the wealthy, it ends up increasing taxes on a lot of poor and middle class people and increasing the deficit really substantially. And that helps explain why when you look at these analyses, it's really not a good bill for large numbers of Americans. And when you look at polling, it's a deeply unpopular bill already.
To come to that assessment, does it mean that you can't be a believer in the, you know, give the wealthy a break and that will be high-octane gas for the economy view of the world?
I think if you believe that the best thing you can do for the economy is to give wealthy people tax cuts, then you could be in favor of this bill. The problem with that view is you can only really believe that by having a highly selective reading of the evidence. I look at most of the evidence over the last 50 years or the last 20, which is actually much more damaging to the trickle-down case, and I say, look, cutting tax cuts for the wealthy is really not the main thing that drives the economy. Bill Clinton raised taxes on the wealthy, and we had the best economy we've had in decades. George W. Bush cut them on the wealthy, and we had a really mediocre expansion. And so you sort of have to go back and say, but Ronald Reagan, and it's true, Ronald Reagan cut taxes on the wealthy, and the economy in the 1980s was quite good. But it's not a serious thing to look at that one data point and then to ignore all the other data points. And so I don't think cutting taxes for the wealthy does huge damage to the overall economy, and I don't think it provides much much of a boost to the overall economy. And so the idea that through trickle down, this bill is going to be great for everyone who's not wealthy strikes me as a pretty ideological argument that isn't based on the evidence.
David, you argue that it doesn't redound to the benefit of the middle class, and we'll look at that because, of course, Republicans are saying again and again that it does. But let's take your assessment for a moment at face value. If so much of the benefit goes to the wealthy, but this is a president who campaigned on the economically, as you like to put it, you know, sort of forgotten or those that the system had just rudely rushed by and left outside the benefits of globalization and all the rest. If it doesn't go to their benefit, then what's the rationale or the motivation for putting the benefits in the wealthy camp?
Well, I think we've seen repeatedly that while Donald Trump had a very effective, more effective than almost any analyst, Republican, Democrat, or outside of the political system, understood. He had a very effective campaign message. That is not how he has governed. He has not governed as someone who has tried to go out and help the same working class and middle class voters whom he appealed to in the campaign. I mean, if you look at the health bill, he was trying to take health care away from millions of them. And so this fits with a pattern in which Trump says one thing and does another. And in that way, yes, it's surprising because it's not how he campaigned for president. But if you've been following the first year of this administration, as you obviously have been closely, in that way, it's not particularly surprising.
I want to get into the details a little bit on where the benefit falls, because Republican leaders in the Senate continue to say that this is for the middle class. Here was Senator Rob Portman, Ohio, just yesterday on Meet the Press, saying, hey, this helps middle class families. Here was the Senator Portman.
It doubles the standard deduction up to 24 grand for a family. It doubles the child tax credit. It lowers the rates to the point that in Ohio, the average is $2,375 for the median income family. And everybody in every group, Chuck, in every bracket, that group as a whole will see tax cuts. And so, you know, it's just been misrepresented.
Rob Portman of Ohio, it's just been misrepresented. And he rolls out the standard deduction and the child tax credit and so on that people see. And they talk a lot about these are going to be better for people without.
Yeah, so that's a great clip to try to unpack. So this bill has a mix of things that help middle and working class families and that hurt middle and working class families. And so what Senator Portman did there was he had two logical sleights of hand. The first was he listed only the things that help middle class and working class families, and he left out all the things that hurt them. So he talked about the fact that they were doubling the standard deduction, mm-hmm. but he left out the fact that they were eliminating the personal exemption. The personal exemption essentially allows you to shield $4,000 of income for every adult or child in your family. So he left that out. He left out the fact that they are changing the inflation adjustment to make it less generous. So over time, more families will creep more quickly into higher tax brackets. The tax code will basically, over time, say, hey, you're doing better than you used to think you were doing, and so we're going to more quickly move you into a bracket where you pay a higher rate. There are a couple of other things that he also didn't list, basically, which fall as middle class and working class tax increases. Maybe the most important is that the bill messes with the healthcare system. And by messing with the healthcare system, it's going to cause premiums to go up for a lot of middle class families. And so when you wash all of this out, what you end up seeing is that for the vast majority of middle class families, it doesn't do very much in the short term. For some of them, it raises taxes. For some of them, it cuts taxes. And then the second sleight of hand that the senator had there was he left out the fact that the stuff that's best for the middle class is set to expire in the bill. That's a really cynical choice by the people who wrote this bill, because basically what they want to be able to go out and do is offer a statistic like Senator Portman just offered, where they say, in the first year, this bill will give you X. But the stuff that's good for the middle class expires in this bill. And the stuff that's really good for the wealthy is permanent. And so if you look at the CBO and others, that's the Congressional Budget Office, basically the independent groups that have analyzed this, they say that by the time the bill is done, it's really much worse for the middle class than when the bill starts.
Maybe the presumption here, I mean, in the House, it doesn't expire, right? In the House version. So maybe they in the joint consideration of this, that goes away, or is that not possible?
Well, here's the problem. They, for technical reasons that we don't have to get into, they're basically limited to a $1.5 trillion price tag over a decade.
That is an increase to the deficit, or is one another way of putting that?
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. So let's think about that for a minute. You have people like Senator Flake from Arizona, Senator Corker from Tennessee, Senator Moran from Kansas. These are all Republicans. Mm-hmm. They've all said they are fiscal conservatives. They're not willing to add to the deficit. Well, even at that price tag, adding $1.5 trillion to the deficit over the decade makes this a really deficit-increasing bill. This is not a fiscally conservative bill. But then if, as you say, well, maybe those temporary tax cuts for the middle class, the ones that are going to expire mm-hmm. and make the bill worse on the middle class, maybe some future Congress will actually extend them. Well, that's true. Maybe some future Congress will. But then this is really a deficit-busting bill. And so then anyone who considers themselves a fiscal conservative, I don't see how they can in good conscience support this if there's kind of a wink and a nod and actually its effect on the deficit is going to be much worse than the official numbers suggest.
If they would drive the deficit in that direction, I mean, some have said this is a way to come back around and look at our major social programs. Down the road, we would have to under the influence of this bill. You have to look at Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security and say, just can't do it. Republicans are saying that already.
That's right. So there are so far the whole way we've been talking about this bill basically imagines that the deficit doesn't need to be solved, right? I've been saying this bill is a huge tax cut for the wealthy. In the short term, it is a small tax cut for most people in the middle class, and it is a tax increase for a substantial minority of the middle class. But we've that whole discussion has been based on the idea that, well, the deficit doesn't need to come down. But that's a fictional world. In the real world, the deficit eventually will need to come down. The U.S. government will have to pay more of its bills. And so the question then becomes, how does the deficit come down? If it comes down through cuts to Social Security and Medicare, as seems likely, then in the end, this bill will actually be deeply bad for most members of the middle class.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the tax plan that could be the law of the land now within a few weeks. The Senate plunges in this week. The president wants it signed before Christmas. David Leonhardt is with us, columnist for The New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winner there. He's been following all this very closely. And you can join us as well. Is there a payoff for everybody here in this plan? Why are we seeing a plan now that would boost the deficit and help the already rich? Apart from a Republican need for a win, what is really driving this thing? Do you believe that it's the drive to try and perk up the economy and get the whole kit and caboodle running better? Before a cabinet meeting last week, here was the president saying this is a big Christmas present for the American people.
We're going to give the American people a huge tax cut for Christmas. Hopefully that will be a great, big, beautiful Christmas present. With the Democrats giving us no votes for tax cuts for purely political reasons, obstructionists, it will be up to the Republicans to come through for America. I think they will. I hope they will. It's up to the Senate.
This week is the Senate's turn. David Leonhardt and a whole lot of other people watching that very closely. Democrats saying no thank you. Here was a minority leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, talking with NPR earlier this month, saying that the country would be better off if it doesn't go through.
We're better off if this tax bill fails, and the reason is simple, twofold. One, two of the greatest problems we face in this country, one is income distribution or maldistribution. This bill exacerbates it. If you're very wealthy, you do a lot better than if you're middle class or poorer. It also gives tax breaks, huge tax breaks, to the wealthiest of corporations. These corporations are flush with money already. They're not creating jobs. More money isn't going to have them create.
Crackling fireplace in the background. They're not an assistant tap dancing next to the senator. But there's the argument from the Democrats. David Leonhardt watching all this and our listeners watching very closely as well. David, we've got callers for you. Justin in Chanute, Kansas. Justin, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just calling in to comment. Every so often they introduce these ideas that cutting taxes on the wealthiest people and companies will stimulate the economy, and it's absolutely ludicrous. As you noted, I live in Kansas, and a couple of terms ago, Governor Brownback sold a tax plan that did that same thing. And he sold it to the people on those same old trickle-down promises that, you know, these individuals and businesses will have more money now to hire more people and stimulate job growth and all these things. And, of course, that's not what we saw at all. These people and these businesses, they took that money, they pocketed it, they did not invest it in job growth or stimulation of any kind, and it created a massive shortfall in our budget that they've been trying to fill ever since by raiding our public services. Our infrastructure budget is destroyed, our education budget has been decimated, and teachers are fleeing the state in droves.
Have you found a way back out of it as a state? Are the Republicans in Kansas claiming victory, Justin?
Oh, yeah, no, they've been claiming victory all along, and, of course, that's absolutely not the case. They just keep claiming it. And, of course, the people who lobbied for this reform have been laughing at us all the way to the bank.
David, what about the Kansas example? People cite it often lately. They've had quite a roller coaster ride there.
They have, and Justin's right. It really has not worked out at all. I mean, it did terrible damage to Kansas's budget. States don't have the ability to run shortfalls the way the federal government does, so Kansas has had to deal with it more quickly. And there have actually been a fair number of Republicans within Kansas who've revolted and voted basically to undo what happened. And so I do think, look, there is no perfect analogy, but I do think the Kansas analogy is a useful analogy. And it's not the only one we have. As Justin said, there's just repeated evidence that this notion that the single best thing you can do for an economy is to cut taxes on the wealthy and on companies just doesn't comport with reality. And one thing to ask is, who is it that's getting the direct benefits of one of these policies, mm-hmm. and who has to wait and hope on the indirect benefits? And the answer here is that the best off people in the country get the direct benefits, and everyone else has to hope for these kind of knock-on effects. And history suggests that they may be waiting a long time for those benefits.
When you read the urgency of Republicans this week, then, I mean, you've been around Washington a long time. Is this above all to get a win on the board, or are there major backers among those who would most directly benefit, and they're really putting the squeeze on for that extra margin of cash in the bank?
I think it's a few things. So you mentioned two things, and I think those are probably the two most important things. One, Republicans control the White House, they control the Senate, they control the House, and they've passed no major piece of legislation. And the idea that they're going to get to the end of 2017 without doing that terrifies many people in the Republican Party. The Lindsey Graham quote you played is a pretty good encapsulation.
Failure is not an option.
That's right, of that fear. And this should be the easiest thing for the Republican Party, cutting taxes. So that is certainly the need to get a win is certainly driving a lot of this. No doubt that a big part of that is that's the case for the president, who doesn't seem to have really specific ideas about policy. He just wants to succeed. The second thing is, yes, political backers and donors matter. And there have even been a few members of Congress who've been honest about this. They've said, look, our donors have said to us, pass this bill or don't call me again. I think that might be an empty threat. I don't think a lot of those wealthy donors are going to suddenly switch to the Democratic Party, but that's certainly what Republicans are hearing. And so they feel like, look, their donors, many of their donors would directly benefit from this bill. And so that's part of the push. And then I do think there is a philosophical belief that many Republicans have in the idea of small government. And if you really believe in small government, maybe you don't have a problem with the bill that initially causes a big increase in the deficit. I don't think you can really call yourself a fiscal conservative in that case. But if you really believe in small government, you say, look, let's cut taxes. We'll mostly cut them for well-off people who currently face the highest tax rates, even if they've come down over time. And that'll drive up the deficit. And then we'll basically have more leverage to cut government. We'll cut education, cut Medicare, cut Social Security. Those programs are popular, so they don't tend to say that out loud. But I do think that's probably driving some of the push here.
Reed, if indeed there are, you know, well-heeled contributors calling and saying, you get this through or don't call me again. And yet for many years now, we've seen how richly the rewards of our economy have gone to a very tiny slice at the top in overwhelming degree. What's driving the appetite so fiercely for tax cuts up there when, I mean, we all know people up there are doing extremely, extremely well?
Yep, they are. There's this concept in social science, though, called the hedonic treadmill. And the idea is, look, when things start going really well, you still want them to go better.
And hedonic is in hedonism. One more yacht, one more, I don't know, two turkeys, not just one at Christmas? Or
yeah, that's right.
Thanksgiving?
And that's right. And so that I don't think people sit around and say, well, I'm doing much better than my parents did. I'm doing much better than I did a decade ago. Therefore, I don't really want any more money. I don't think that's the way human beings operate. And so, yes, people want more. I'm not defending that. I think it's deeply problematic in terms of, look, if you care about the situation of this country, if you care about how powerful a country the United States is, and I know that's language that sometimes bothers people on the left, but I do care about how strong and powerful the United States is. I believe it's a much better force in the world than many of the other most powerful governments around. It historically,
well, I mean, if you care about it as a vessel of values that we cherish.
Yes. If you care about democracy, if you care about the condition of this country, this bill should alarm you because it does the most to help people who are already the most comfortable and doing the best, and it weakens our government and leaves the government with much less money. It doesn't even make a lot of hard choices. And so basically, it's a huge handout for people who are already doing really, really well. And that is why we see so many dishonest talking points from the bill's supporters. That's why we see them leave out the fact that the middle class tax cuts expire. That's why we see them listing all the good things for the middle class in the bill and leaving out all the bad things for the middle class.
But that still confuses me, David, because even if you're really loaded as an American, I think you'd want the country to be strong just as a base for living in as a healthy society. And B, if you care about those values, and Americans historically have, you want a country that's got the national strength to support them, to champion them. Russia doesn't care about those values. China cares very little about those values.
Yep, I agree. Well, look, most Americans agree with you. If you look at the polling on this bill, it's enormously unpopular. I mean, its approval ratings are in the mid-20s, which means it doesn't even have that kind of core of 35% or so of people who consistently say they approve of President Trump's performance. So most Americans don't think this is a particularly good bill. When you look at the state-based polling in places like Arizona, one of whose senators, John McCain, will probably help decide the fate of the bill, you see the same thing. People in Arizona don't think this is going to benefit them. So the question is, well, why do very affluent people, why do so many of them support the bill? First of all, there are a lot of affluent people who don't want this to pass. But second of all, that's why you see this whole line that, hey, this bill is passing tax cuts for the so-called job creators is actually the best thing we could do for the economy. People are basically constructing a story that makes them feel like, can make them feel like, can make them rationalize that a bill that is really a big handout for them personally actually helps the country. And they come to believe their own spin about it, I think.
But just for the record, aren't American corporations already sitting on historic high, huge piles of cash at the moment?
Yes.
Okay. Kelly in Dauphin Island, Alabama. Oh, boy. I used to go there as a kid. Remember it well. Loved it. Kelly, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well, Kelly. What do you see?
Good. Well, not only does this tax bill ignore a lot of economic principles, but the most ironic part of it is that by increasing our budget deficit to a great extent, Donald Trump is actually hurting the trade deficit further. And that happens because in order to get people to buy the debt, they have to increase the interest rate.
That we'll pay on it.
The increased interest rate, it increases the strength of the dollar. A strong dollar means less export. So Donald Trump is failing Econ 101 here.
David, what do you say? Kelly's watching
yes.
closely from Dauphin, from the coast of Alabama.
yes, look, this bill is not good for the U.S. economy. It's not that it has nothing good for the U.S. economy in it. It has it. The health care bills really had virtually no good ideas in them. These bills have, you know, a handful of good ideas in them. I think cutting the corporate rate is a good idea. But it's then mixed up with so many bad things. I mean, Kelly's right. She's focusing on this increase in the deficit. And so even if cutting the corporate rate has some good effects for the economy, they're going to be swamped by what this bill does to the deficit and the dollar. It's interesting that Ron Johnson, who is a Wisconsin senator, who he has a pattern of raising what sound like serious objections to bills and then basically voting for the bills anyway.
Okay.
That's what he did on health care. So I don't put a lot of stock in his concerns.
He's saying it doesn't help a small and medium-sized businesses enough.
And he's particularly concerned that it's going to hurt American businesses at the expense of foreign businesses. And so I assume Ron Johnson in the end will fold because has been his history. But maybe it won't be in this case. And that's yet another example, as Kelly is pointing out, that from a macroeconomic perspective, this bill it's a hodgepodge and it's really damaging. And look, it was hastily constructed. There still hasn't been a single hearing in which experts have been allowed to come forward and debate this bill. And so even if you find all of this technical stuff complicated and you're trying to figure out what to make of this bill, what I would tell you is ask yourself, why is it that the people supporting this bill don't want to have substantive discussion of the bill? They are afraid of sunlight. They haven't been willing to have hearings where experts from both sides, supporters and opponents, come forward. And the reason is they know that sunlight is bad for this bill, that the more people look into this, the more they're going to see the different ways it could hurt American companies and American workers and the American economy.
Boy, it's strange, though, because these bills don't pass often. And when they do, then you live with them often for decades. It can be a big deal. Linda in Huntersville, North Carolina. Linda, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. When this bill was first presented to the people, one of the promises was that they would do away with the loopholes used by the big corporations.
Yes.
I cannot remember the last time I heard that mentioned, so I'm assuming that's been dropped. Could you comment, please?
Okay. Thank you, Linda. David, how about it? Is it if they get the big corporate tax rate break, do the loopholes get closed?
No, Linda is correct. They've done the easy part and taken out the hard part. In any tax reform, it's sort of a mix of dessert and spinach, which I actually like to eat spinach, so I probably shouldn't use that analogy. But it's a mix of dessert and vegetables, right? The dessert is you cut people's tax rates, and the vegetables are you take away some of their tax breaks.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the analysis of this bill, what you see is that the corporate rate, the changes in the corporate tax code would enormously increase the deficit. And that's because they do the easy stuff, they do the dessert, and they don't do the hard stuff. They don't figure out ways to take away tax breaks from companies.
They literally do not. I mean, I thought that was Linda's right at the beginning of this conversation. That was the whole idea. Our corporate tax rate's too high, we're going to bring it down, and we're going to take away these loopholes because it doesn't make sense when you've got a lower tax rate.
There's some modest stuff around the edges so that allows them to say we're doing this here or we're doing this there. But really, if you look at it on net, the reports from the Joint Committee on Taxation, they're very clear that on net, the corporate tax cuts have a huge effect on driving up the deficit. So that shows you that basically they're doing the easy stuff without the hard stuff. True tax reform in which you – revenue neutral tax reform in which you lower rates and also get rid of the loopholes that Linda's talking about can mostly wash out. But this doesn't wash out. It has a huge increase on the deficit because they do the easy stuff without the hard stuff. In fact, most of the hard stuff is focused on individuals. So basically, it is a cut in the corporate rate, which mostly benefits affluent people because affluent people disproportionately own corporate stock. And on the individual side, it's a mix of the good and bad. So earlier you played that clip where Senator Portman listed the ways that this helped individuals.
Yep.
He didn't list any of the ways it hurts individuals. So for individuals, it sort of is tax reform with some good and bad stuff. For companies, it's basically just all good stuff.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the tax plan that could be the law of the land within a few weeks now. The Senate plunges in this week. The president wants it signed before Christmas. David Liedhardt is with us, columnist for the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winner, former Washington bureau chief there. He's been watching very, very closely. You can join us this hour. What do you think? One percenters. Are you going to hire more or expand if this goes through? And where would this bill point the country? Republicans very clear. They want, they need a win. Here's John Thune, South Dakota, on Fox News Sunday.
We need to get this accomplishment. This is a goal that we've had for a long time. The tax code in this country needs to be changed. If we're going to be competitive in the global marketplace, our businesses are not competitive today. If we want to get the economy growing at a faster rate, creating better paying jobs, raising wages in this country, we need to get this tax bill across the finish line.
That's the Republican headline. We're looking at the details. Luke in Bristol, Tennessee. Luke, you're on with David Liedhardt in Washington.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Okay, what do you see, Luke? What's your question?
The biggest thing I don't get about this whole tax plan is the Republicans have been pushing this through and keeping most everyday Americans, unless you stay informed pretty much every day, they're keeping them out of the loop on everything, just giving them vague details. But they keep saying that it's a cut for the middle class and it's going to lower taxes and this and that. But I'm a union pipe welder and pipe fitter, so I feel like I know pretty well about the middle class.
Okay.
And one of the things in this tax bill it does, it eliminates personal deductions. So I travel all over the country working at power plants and refineries and nuclear power plants and everything else, and I use those deductions for my travel expenses at the end of the year. So I don't see how – I mean, I had a substantial amount last year, so I don't see how me losing tens of thousands of dollars in deductions is helping a middle-class American like me and my family. And, you know, there's just so many other things that, like, they just keep out of the loop. They don't mention, and people should stay more informed on, like, they want to eliminate the estate tax. You know, I live in a pretty red part of Tennessee, northeast Tennessee. Okay. It was heavily Trump.
Okay.
And it's just people don't stay informed on these things, and you get in political debates with them, and they're like, oh, well, he's eliminating the estate tax. Like, that's not going to help us unless you're extremely wealthy in the 1%. I mean, things like that don't do anything for average Americans. And, you know, like I said, the Republicans need a win here. So it seems like they're pretty much just scrapping for whatever they can get. And then the rest of us middle-class Americans are supposed to just make up the difference. And I don't, that's just my point of view on it.
Luke, we'll look at the details on what could hit individuals. But just, I mean, you're a smart guy. Give us your reading on how this plays out politically. You say you're in a red part of Tennessee, and I see that. And went pretty strong for Trump. But if this goes through and it doesn't come with the promised benefits, do you see a political price to pay? Or people are so in love with the music of it or the themes that are put out there that they don't pay attention to the details?
That's exactly what I think. I think it really doesn't matter. I think that it really doesn't matter that they'll still vote Republican because that's how they've been raised. And I'm not saying that people in my area, all of them are ignorant, but there are a lot of, you know, ignorance throughout the United States. People don't want to accept, you know, that this party could be hurting them on both sides. I mean, there's good and bad on both.
Absolutely.
I feel like as Americans, we should stay a little bit. I feel like as Americans, we should get a little bit more educated. That way, we can tackle these problems head on through elections and things. That way, these problems don't seem to come up again. And what we're talking about with, you know, it hurts middle class Americans like me. Like I said, I go work all these different power plants and things that help power the United States, you know?
Yep.
So, of course, if I can't afford to travel and go work these power plants, then that's going to hurt. And there's hundreds of thousands of construction workers like me, you know, that are unionized, and there's more that aren't, you know, because unfortunately we're on the decline. But, you know, that hurts infrastructure. If these companies can't man the work, they won't be able to get jobs. And if they can't get bids, you know, that harms all of America. It doesn't just harm, you know, the middle class. It's just, I feel like I said, I don't know, I feel like we should just stay informed more as Americans. And I feel like that these Republicans that get on national television and just spout vague descriptions of the tax bill, they should be held accountable.
Luke, we're working on the informed part here. We're doing our best and fit those pipes well when you're at those power plants. And I hope it works out for you. But I hear the point that you're making pretty loud and clear. David Liedhardt, what about personal deductions? And take us down or on down through the list of, you know, we got the fun stuff. What about for individuals, the things that could be problematic?
I'm happy to do that. Let me just briefly respond to Luke's point on politics, if that's okay, Tom.
Sure, please.
I mean, I think on both sides, people don't vote their economic interests really frequently. And I think that's okay, right? If there are Republican voters out there who say, look, I'm not going to vote for – I'm not going to base my vote a few hundred dollars one way or another on a tax cut because I feel really strongly about gun rights and I feel really strongly about abortion and I feel really strongly about
these other things. That's their right.
You see the same thing on the left, right? You have a lot of affluent people who vote for candidates who would raise their taxes because they agree with those Democratic candidates on other issues.
Okay.
There's nothing wrong with that. I think the thing that is really tricky for Republicans here is that they are promising something that they are not delivering. And as Luke said, they're promising a middle-class tax cut, and this doesn't deliver it. And I think they're a little bit in a corner now because either this bill is going to fail and they are going to look incompetent, which they are obviously terrified by, or it's going to succeed, which seems more likely, absent some big outpouring of public opposition to the bill, as we saw in the healthcare bill. Mm-hmm. It's going to succeed, and then they're going to pass a bill that really doesn't live up to its promises. So to your point, these are the ways in which the bills cuts taxes. There are about, depending how you count it, about six. It lowers rates. That mostly benefits the people at the very top. It increases the standard deduction. That benefits a lot of people throughout the tax code. It allows more people to act as companies. You may have heard of this. Your listeners may have heard of it as the pass-through. Mm-hmm. That mostly benefits the well-off. It increases the child tax credit. That tends to benefit the middle class and others. It gets rid of the alternative minimum tax. That gets rid of that really helps people toward the top. And it gets rid of the estate tax. Luke said the estate tax applies to the 1%. He was actually being charitable. The estate tax tends to apply only to the top 0.2%.
And let's be clear, that would allow them to take their full fortune that they built in this country and just hand it to their kids without taxation.
Right. So those are basically the six things that cut taxes in this bill. And four of the six really tend to help people at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Not just that. But some of the ones that help people toward the middle, like the standard deduction, expire before the bill does. They leave the law. The things that that are basically tax increases in this bill, I count five. It essentially gets rid of the personal exemption. That's the $4,000 of income you can keep shielded from tax for every person. It gets rid of a lot of itemized deductions, just like Luke was talking about.
That sounds like a big deal for him. I mean, if that's vital to his work, but he won't be able to deduct that. Ouch.
Yes, there are a lot of middle class losers from this bill. A lot. The third is what it does on healthcare. It's by messing with the healthcare markets, it's going to cause premiums to go up for a lot of people.
You mean by taking away the individual mandate, which is in the Senate plan?
That's right. So if you get rid of the individual mandate, what ends up happening is fewer healthy people sign up for insurance, either because they're not aware of the penalty or the individual mandate in a funny way acts as advertising. There are a lot of people out there who don't necessarily understand they're eligible for Medicaid mm-hmm. or they're eligible for federally subsidized private insurance plans. Mm-hmm. And when they hear that the federal government requires them to have health insurance, they go looking. And then they realize, oh, wait a second, I can get health insurance quite inexpensively. If you take away the mandate, some of those people aren't going to go looking.
Yeah.
You're going to have fewer healthy people. It's going to cause healthcare costs to go up. The fourth is the way it deals with inflation, which basically over time pushes people into higher tax brackets more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And the fifth, which is arguably the biggest, is this idea that it causes the deficit to go up so much that eventually the deficit will have to be brought down. And the only way to bring down the deficit that doesn't basically hurt the middle class more than this bill is by just getting rid of this bill. So you assume that getting rid of the deficit is also going to hurt the middle class. So when you look at the five tax increases in this bill, they are all things that really affect the middle class, whereas the big categories of tax cuts are really focused on the wealthy. They're not exclusively for the wealthy. There's some good stuff in this bill for the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
But on net, this is a really damaging bill for the middle class. And again, if you find all this talk of tax policy kind of eye-glazing, focus on the fact that the people pushing this bill are trying to rush it through. They're trying to do without hearings. They're trying to do it before we get the official scores of the bill. And the reason they're doing that is they understand that sunlight is bad for this bill. It will make people understand even more so that this bill does not help the American economy.
I mean, you take away the estate tax, that is sort of the definition of ways to cement in a kind of aristocracy at the top where there's so much money. Just that for starters. And then if you build in a deficit, that means social programs that are pretty fundamental, like Social Security and Medicare, have to be really whacked down the road. Take us through, David, you're right there. You're watching closely. This comes down to a very few votes that will make the difference this week.
Yes.
On whether this continues, the surge toward a Christmas signing. Whose votes are uncertain and what are the prospects?
So I would start with the five Republicans who have already shown a willingness to be independent from party leaders and defy party leaders. Those five are Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, who opposed the health care bills earlier this year that would have taken insurance from a lot of people. At this point, Murkowski seems to be leaning more positively to the bill than Collins.
Is that because they're going to open up oil drilling in northern Alaska?
Precisely. Murkowski likes the idea of opening up more of Alaska to oil drilling. The bill has that tucked into it, so she tends to like that. Mm-hmm. But they're both uncertain. Look, this bill would hurt a lot of people in Maine and Alaska. Those are not wealthy states.
Because?
For all the reasons we've been talking
about. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. So then the next two of these five are Jeff Flake, who has announced he's not running again, who's been really clashing with Trump, and Bob Corker, also announced he's not running again, from Tennessee. Mm-hmm. These are Republicans who say they are fiscal conservatives. They say they won't vote to increase the deficit. If you take them at their word, they really can't vote for this bill, absent radical changes, because this bill would hugely increase the deficit. And then the fifth is John McCain, who was, of course, the most dramatic participant in the health care bill. John McCain is quite ill. He's received a diagnosis of aggressive cancer. That suggests that he will not run for re-election when his term expires. And he has really been making a stand on the idea of the principle of the Senate itself, that the Senate should be a great institution where we debate these big questions rather than rushing through bills. And I think what we don't know is how bothered McCain is by the fact that this bill at the last moment, well, not the last moment, but late in the game, snuck in this pretty radical change to health care, which was the kind of thing that he voted against earlier this year. Those are those five.
So out of those five, they need two holdouts? If those opponents of the bill, if for not to pass, or how many?
Well, so if you assume the Democrats will remain united on this, and I assume they will, it's hard to imagine a Democrat voting for an unpopular bill that raises taxes on a lot of middle-class people and cuts taxes on the wealthy and increases the deficit. I don't see the political pressure there, even on Democrats who are in Trump-won states who are running for mm-hmm. re-election. Then Republicans can lose only two votes. If they lose two, it'll be a 50-50 tie, and Mike Pence, the vice president, will break the tie and it'll pass. If they lose three, as they did on health care, it goes down to defeat 41-59. The five I mentioned aren't the only five in play. There are also roughly another five. Jerry Moran of Kansas, James Lankford of Oklahoma, Rand Paul of Kentucky, a couple others. I'm a little bit more skeptical about those other five because in the end, those other five have tended to vote with party leaders when push comes to shove. But look, this is a really problematic bill, and I think it's possible that a Republican who has not previously broken ranks will look at this bill and say, you know what? I'm usually there as a reliable vote for Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump, but I'm just not able to get there on this bill.
Boy, they're setting it up, though, so that anybody who does that is going to be – they know in advance they're going to be painted as the black sheep of the party.
Yes. So one question is, do any of these roughly 10 that we're talking about mm-hmm. band together, right? If three or four or even just three of these 10 went to Senate leadership and say, hey, look, we're not willing to vote for a bill that does this on the deficit, period. We are solid on this. The three of us are solid. You need to rewrite the bill. The leadership would then have to do that. Maybe they even go as four, so no one of them can be picked off. The question is, are they willing to do that, or do they put more stock in the idea of getting a win, as you said earlier?
What about the Dreamer, the DACA piece of this? Might that tempt over some Democrat? What's the amendment that's there on that front?
I mean, Yes, you could imagine they put something, they try to make this really hard on Democrats, and they put something in the bill that would essentially extend legal status to mm-hmm. Dreamers. But I find that really unlikely. The politics of that on the Republican side are really, really hard. The idea that you could keep all Republicans by putting that in. And look, the Democrats have shown a lot of discipline this year, right? I mean, on the left, you didn't have Bernie Sanders saying, hey, I'm willing to repeal health insurance because it gets us closer to single payer. And you didn't have mm-hmm. people in the center of the Democratic coalition willing to go along with the president just because he won their state. And so until we see something else, I'm going to assume that on a bill that is this unpopular and substantively this flawed, that the Democrats are going to be able to hold all 48 of their members against the bill.
We've got half a minute or so. If this goes through or doesn't, and think about the kind of country we are. How does it change if this goes through?
Look, it exacerbates a lot of the trends we've already seen in which ever more of the gains of our economy, the fruits of our economy, go to a relatively small group of people at the top who are already doing well. And that has the potential to cause even more anger toward the government. My hope would be that it'll end up backfiring and that we could get it repealed within a few years. But the better bet is to defeat it now.
Maybe in defeat, it gets into a bigger conversation and produces a better bill next year, David.
That'd be great. Look, there is a version of tax reform that conservatives and liberals could really agree on that would help the economy, and I would love to see that bill.
Maybe that, maybe just the opposite. We're going to know, very likely, this week. David Leonhardt, columnist for The New York Times, has been a really informative hour, and we are grateful for it. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for all your calls and comments, as always. It is great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.